Welcome to the Interpreter Insights podcast. I'm Martin Tanner, your host. Today's insights are into the Latter-day Saint idea of the Constitution hanging by a thread. Please know that the Interpreter Foundation supports the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship of all kinds. Please take a look at interpreterfoundation.org, where you will find all of the offerings of the Interpreter Foundation. Please tell your friends about this and forthcoming Interpreter Insights episodes and give me a 5-star rating. And one more thought, because the Interpreter Foundation is not owned or controlled by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the comments I make are solely my responsibility. And now, insights into the Constitution hanging by a thread. This is a topic that is known widespread throughout the church, and it is attributed to Joseph Smith. But when people talk about the concept, they, interestingly enough, quote from others. Brigham Young has two prominent quotes about the time coming in the future when the Constitution will hang as by a single thread. He made one of those in 1854, found in Journal of Discourses, Volume 7, at page 15. And he made another one in 1868, recorded in Journal of Discourses, Volume 12, at page 204. There are many, many other prominent Latter-day Saint leaders who said similar things. I'll mention just a few of those. Orson Hyde in 1858, as recorded in Volume 6 of the Journal of Discourses on page 152, talked about Joseph Smith saying that the Constitution would hang as by a single thread. John Taylor said the same thing in 1879. Journal of Discourses, Volume 21, page 8. And then, much more recently, Harold B. Lee, in his statement in 1852 General Conference, in the conference reports, and Melvin J. Ballard in 1933, in the conference reports, also said that the Constitution would hang as by a thread because Joseph Smith had said so. Now, fascinatingly enough, you cannot find a statement where Joseph Smith said the Constitution would hang as by a single thread. If he said those very words, they're not recorded anywhere. But we do have a very similar statement by Joseph Smith so that we know that he did have that idea. It was recorded by Corey, who was a marvelous scribe for Joseph Smith at many of his discourses. This was a conference statement of Joseph Smith on April 6th of 1840. And if you look at the 1840 discourse, you will find that Joseph Smith didn't use the hanging by a thread idea, but he said this, according to Corey. Quote, "The Constitution would be brought to the very verge of crumbling to pieces and tumbling to the ground. And then, when the Constitution is upon the brink of ruin, this people," meaning the Latter-day Saints, "will be the staff upon which the nation shall lean, and they shall bear the Constitution away from the very verge of destruction." Close quote. Fascinating quote, easy to find in the Joseph Smith papers. This particular comment of Joseph Smith's was probably made because of the harsh things that happened to the Latter-day Saints in the persecutions in Missouri and in Nauvoo, for which there was no redress, and which were actually caused by governmental officials. If you want to read something that is a complete tearjerker, Take a look at the redress petitions of the Latter-day Saints, which were compiled. These were the losses that the Latter-day Saints suffered at the hands of their enemies. And they cataloged all of their losses and asked for redress from the federal government, which was never given. Because of this, Joseph Smith had what we would describe, I suppose, as a love-hate relationship with the Constitution of the United States. It was a close relationship because we know that the Doctrine and Covenants tells us that the Constitution was created by just men who were raised up for that very purpose. D&C 101, 88, I believe. And so the Constitution is divinely inspired, and yet it has failed the Latter-day Saints. And most people today would say that in many ways the Constitution has lost ground. And then the question would be, if it's going to be saved by the Latter-day Saints, what would that look like? This is a question that I've looked into in quite a bit of detail, and it's a fascinating question for several reasons. The first reason is because we will never make the Constitution the way it originally was for several reasons, which I'll get into in a minute, among which would be that that would mean that women would no longer have the right to vote because it took quite a while until 1920 for women to get the right to vote. You want to go back to the original Constitution? That would go away. That's not going to happen. The idea of the Constitution has always been a marvelous thing. There has been a great deal of, shall we say, shift or change or encroachment on the original ideas. I'm going to go through a series of the changes that have happened, not all of them, not by any stretch, but a few of the main ones, so that you'll have a sense of how different the Constitution is seen and applied today compared with how it was when it was originally enacted. Let's start off with the First Amendment. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion. This is a core value of the United States. After all, it's the First Amendment. It guarantees freedom of speech and freedom of religion. We have a pretty good handle on freedom of speech, although there is this sad trend that's been going around for a number of years about canceling people just for saying something that a certain group does not like. That is very anti-Constitution, anti-First Amendment. The idea about freedom of religion has definitely shifted. Today, there are many people on the left politically and right who would believe in the idea of separation of church and state. That is absolutely not what the founding fathers had in mind. And I'll give you some examples. Benjamin Franklin, after the First Amendment was enacted, suggested, and he was serious about it, that the Bible should be the textbook for schools all across the country. Grade schools, what we would now consider high schools, people should learn to read and study the Bible. Another significant change is the idea that religion should be out of government. That wasn't what was intended by the First Amendment either. The whole language of the First Amendment pertaining to religion was that there would be no laws restricting it. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That's the language. Congress, in other words, the U.S. government, is not supposed to stop religion. The day the First Amendment was enacted, Congress provided a law that opens and closes every session of Congress with a prayer by a paid chaplain. So tax dollars go to pay for a chaplain to open and close each session of Congress. That does not sound like Congress was ever intended to be completely separated from religion. Another fascinating part of this is the background. While the Constitutional Convention was ongoing, a number of those there, but particularly again Franklin, moved or filed a motion that each session of the debates and discussions be opened and closed with a prayer to Almighty God seeking his assistance in the deliberations. That does not sound like a group that had the idea that religion should not be in government. And then we have some of the additional details about how we have In God We Trust on coins and the Pledge of Allegiance, which only in the 1960s was for many purposes removed by Madeline Murray O'Hare, the avowed atheist, who was supported by a very liberal court. One of the biggest ideas that is sort of left in the minds of most people because of these things is that there should not be religion involved with school or with the federal government. If you look at James Madison's drafts of the First Amendment, it's pretty clear that the goal was to not have a church that was an official religion. It was not that there should be no religious activities in the federal government. Another point that's important to make is that the Danbury Baptist letter, which Thomas Jefferson penned, which was used by the court and twisted, by the court, I mean the U.S. Supreme Court, and twisted in its meaning, was meant that a wall of separation between church and state meant that the government could do nothing to harm or cause problems to the Danbury Baptists, which was a good thing. Thomas Jefferson also penned a beautiful statute, which was a statute for Virginia, and it was essentially a bill for religious freedom, and it asked for toleration. Today, many people don't look for toleration. They actually try to stop religion. They don't tolerate it. The idea that Jefferson had and the others had was that you don't have to believe anybody's religion, but you shouldn't have the right to stop their free expression of it. Just tolerate it. Just shrug your shoulders and move on. Now to another significant difference between the way things were when the Constitution was enacted and the way they are now. Federal government used to be very, very limited. Now, through the Commerce Clause and federal preemption, many, many state laws have been preempted and superseded by federal laws. That was not the way it was originally intended. Some of those are probably very good because the Bill of Rights now applies to all the states. It originally only applied to the federal government. I don't think anybody would want to go back to the original way the Constitution was and have no Bill of Rights applied to the states. Courts in the late 1700s and most of the 1800s and even beyond into the early 20th century most always limited their rulings to interpreting the law instead of making new law. That is a significant change of the rule and value of courts. Another significant change in the Constitution is the right to vote. I alluded to this earlier. This is a fascinating change. The right to vote used to be at the time of the Constitution, and this was not by accident, the Founding Fathers wanted this, was limited to landowners who at the time were almost exclusively men who were 21 years old and up. And you had to be a property owner. The idea there was that you had to have a stake in the outcome, a stake in the land, as they described it. that meant that since only men could vote and only men with a significant amount of property, in some states you had to own 50 acres. That meant that for the first 50 or so years, and perhaps more, of the time in the United States after the Constitution was enacted, about 10% of the population were authorized to vote. Surprisingly enough to many, the first place on the planet that gave women the right to vote was the territory of Utah. That happened in 1869. Brigham Young was behind that push, and there were some fascinating reasons for that. Utah women felt highly emancipated because they had the right to vote, and Susan B. Anthony came out to Utah many times and met with the Relief Society to find out how they got all this power out in Utah, how they got to vote and do many, many other things which were unheard of in other places in the country. Based on the church influence in 1870, Wyoming enacted a law allowing women to vote. In 1870, the 15th Amendment was ratified, and so at that point, you had all men, black and white, in the North and South that could vote, and you had women in Utah and Wyoming who could also vote. At that point in time, the idea was still there that you should be a citizen and have a stakeholder, or have a stakeholding, I should say. And here's the thinking behind that. The idea is that if you have a real stakehold, if you own significant property, then that means that you will not vote to take property away from others because you have it yourself. That is a fascinating concept, one that has gone away. I heard it described by a constitutional scholar once as this idea. If you are involved in law or medicine or accounting or construction or any other major area of the part of our society, do you want people who are knowledgeable about your area to be enacting laws that apply to you? Or do you want 18-year-olds who have no real background? Here's another example. If you were a physician, do you want young people voting to change the laws as it's applied to medicine? Probably not. Another significant change that has happened vis-a-vis the Constitution is that senators were originally chosen by the state legislature. The thinking there was that it would stop federal overreach and unfunded mandates and to protect states' rights. If a senator, for example, knew that what they were doing was going to cause states to spend a lot of money or take away states' rights, they wouldn't do it. But with the general populist vote, things like that tend to happen now quite often. If all of these things, well, one more real quickly. We have people elected to federal office, not by a popular vote, but by a system with an electoral college. A lot of people don't understand how this works. Each state has two electors, one for each senator. They also have additional electors, one for each member of the House of Representatives from that state. So, for example, California has 52 plus the two for each senator. And every state has at least three electors, even the very, very smallest states. And that's a way to have a little bit more influence by smaller states. So it's not California and New York and Texas and Florida that influence every single election. That's the thinking behind the Electoral College. It's also the same thinking as the reason why there are two bodies in the electorate, both the Senate and the House. It's a way to sort of divide the power so the big states don't have all the power. If all of these changes were made, and if somehow women did not have the right to vote, it would make a big difference. There would be far fewer laws, and the election outcomes would shift far more to the political right. Women and minorities tend to vote more to the political left, and men, especially older men, tend to vote more to the political right. When the church has within it the idea of the Constitution on the verge of crumbling or hanging as by a single thread, and the idea of going back to the Constitution in its original form, there are, to sum things up, things that we would do today to get it close to the original form and things that we certainly would not do. Women will always have the right to vote. I suspect that 18-year-olds will always have the right to vote. Beyond that, the idea of more religion in society is probably an idea that might be a good one because it would instill more moral values. But that leaves for us as Latter-day Saints to contemplate about what it would really mean if we were at the point where we could have a big influence on moving back to the original Constitution. The law school at Brigham Young University, J. Reuben Clark Law School, was founded with this very idea in mind. The Brethren thought that if the Constitution were to be saved, we should have good Latter-day Saint legal scholars who would understand it and be able to do that very thing with great knowledge rather than a feeble background. If you have a question or comment about this podcast, feel free to email me, martinstanner@gmail.com. I'll be happy to respond. Consider giving me a 5-star review. We'll see you again next time. Thanks for listening.